in regards to class action suits. There's all kinds of issues that could be come together to be a complementary package that could well be. CAPS could well be a part of it, but then again, there may be other packages of opportunity that if they're put together the right way, they may not have to be.
If I may address that, at the end of last session, the individuals who represent doctors, the medical society, the trial lawyers, the insurance industry, the leaders of all four legislative caucuses, as well as the governor's office, really worked hard to try and come up with a package. We agreed to 44 items that would be part of a bill. Unfortunately, we fell short on a couple. We need to go back to the bargaining table. We need to provide real tort reform that stops frivolous lawsuits. We need to provide needed insurance reform that can reduce rates. And we need to work with all the individuals involved to do that. The problem that we have with CAPS in Illinois is they have been declared unconstitutional twice. Whether you agree with that or disagree with that, that's the fact. What we need to do is pass a bill that's going to reduce premiums, cut back on frivolous lawsuits, make sure that it's constitutional so that it will actually have the effect of reducing premiums.
I'm going to go on to another topic here. Representative Hoffman, a year ago, this governor sat up here and attacked the State Board of Education for over an hour. This time we didn't have that kind of speech.
Well, I think that last year, I think the State Board of Education deserved to be attacked. I mean, everybody knows the stories. Whether you worked as a teacher or worked as an administrator in schools, the State Board was this bloated bureaucracy that really needed reforming. The governor didn't get everything that he asked for last year with regard to reforming the State Board, but he did get responsibility and accountability that we, throughout the legislative process, have put on the State Board. And I think that's gone a long way to doing a couple things. He talked about reducing the backlog of 7,000 teachers whose certification was in bureaucratic limbo. That's been cleaned up. They're beginning to reduce some of the needless rules and regulations that are put on schools so that the teachers can't be in the classrooms doing what they're supposed to be doing, and that's teaching. So I believe that we've made the State Board of Education accountable by making them accountable to us, the legislature. And I believe that we've gone a long way to do that. I would like to applaud the governor today by taking a more of a visionary approach to looking at jobs and economic development and really the state of our state and what we need to do to move forward in creating those jobs and economic development.
You've been listening to live coverage of Governor Rod Blagojevich's State of the State message to the Illinois legislature and reaction from Democratic House Member Jay Hoffman and Republican Senator Dan Rutherford. And we anticipate that that coverage is about to wrap up, so we're going to hop out here. This is AM 580 WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. We go now to a program from the Afternoon Magazine Archives, this program recorded in October of last year. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Today in this portion of the program, we take a look at American foreign policy. Our guest is journalist Michael Hirsch, a senior editor in the Washington Bureau for Newsweek magazine. He's also the author of At War With Ourselves, Why America is Squandering Its Chance to Build a Better World. The book looks at the foreign policy choices of two administrations, former President Bill Clinton and incumbent George W. Bush. Hirsch examines the successes and failures of the two administrations. He argues U.S. security requires the respect and cooperation of the international community. He says America has a responsibility to use its power to maintain world stability. And he uses the words permanent quagmire to describe the current foreign policy landscape. Michael Hirsch's book, At War With Ourselves, now available in paperback. Michael Hirsch, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Good afternoon. Happy to be here.
At the outset of the book, early in the book, you say that polls show that most of us feel in our bones that we should be engaged in the world, for example, by paying our dues to the UN, but we're wary of being pulled in too deeply. Why do you suppose that's the case?
I think it's an age-old American psychological dynamic that's going on here and that we see played out to this very day, where, you know, since the founding of the Republic, we have seen ourselves as a nation apart, protected by our broad oceans. Conceptually, you know, America was this grand experiment of democracy and freedom, and we didn't want to get contaminated by the old world, especially Europe. And so you see in all of our foreign policy, even the most internationalist foreign policy in the 20th century, a kind of one foot in, one foot out approach. Even when we were so active in helping to create the world order, we did it kind of furtively. We didn't go around sort of boasting about all of our world building, because we didn't want to sort of provoke this other part of the American psyche, which is to be, you know, is nativist, is, if not quite isolationist, certainly is not glad to embrace the rest of the world freely.
Yeah. And is that why you've selected the title you have, At War With Ourselves? Does that sum it up?
It does. I mean, the title, I guess the book is a sort of an attempt at a national psychohistory, if you will, an attempt to explain why it is that if America created all of these institutions, why it has such a hard time embracing them. The United Nations is a wonderful example. You know, constantly in American political dialogue, particularly in the last couple of years over Iraq, you see the United Nations portrayed as a foreign entity. Well, it's in New York. You know, it's as much of a landmark as the World Trade Center towers once were. We created it. It's the labor of love of three major 20th century presidents, beginning with Wilson, whose aborted attempt at the League of Nations later yielded the United Nations, FDR, Truman. And yet we have a hard time taking ownership of it. And I think that really goes to the problems we have psychologically in accepting the idea that the international system as a whole is largely our creation.
Yeah. Do you think our attitudes about foreign policy and our involvement in the world have shifted since September 11th? And are we now more willing to look, because of the situation we're in, to look to the United Nations and NATO and other organizations, other nations around the globe, for international cooperation?
Well, I mean, not enough, Celeste, is what I would argue. Mm-hmm. If you look at the tenor of the dialogue now in the last stages of the presidential campaign, Bush challenges Kerry on the question of whether he would meet a global test for action or for policy, suggesting that that he, Kerry, would need, you know, would give the rest of the world a veto. I mean, this is dialogue on a very low level, considering the facts on the ground, which are that we badly need the United Nations. I mean, the Bush administration, after essentially snubbing the United Nations for a couple of years, practically went begging hat in hand, asking for its participation in elections in Iraq, because we had no choice, because the Iraqi leaders were insisting that they get some sort of UN cover. Similarly with NATO. We're practically begging NATO to come into Iraq and to take a larger role in Afghanistan. And I think that's indicative of where we still have to go psychologically as a country in accepting the idea that indeed, as unpleasant as many of these institutions are, you know, no one is crazy about the way the UN functions, for example. As unpleasant as they are, we badly need them. There simply is no way around them.
Speaking of unpleasant, you use the term permanent quagmire to describe the current foreign policy landscape. Why that term?
It's a pretty ugly term, isn't it? As I acknowledge in the book. I basically say there's no way around it. This is just effectively our role as the dominant power of the era. And we are dominant, you know, despite the fact that we're strapped down in Iraq and we're having all these other problems. There's no question of American dominance. And what we found is, particularly in the age of terror, when we've seen that the worst threats to us, like 9/11, can come from the most areas that we once thought were marginal, like Afghanistan, places we once thought we didn't have to think about. That what you have is just a lot of brush fires out there that simply need to be put out and managed, and you never can quite, you know, make your way through them. I mean, I think Iraq, for example, is going to be something of a quagmire for a long time. It may not burst into full blown civil war, we hope. But it's going to be something we're going to have to keep a lid on, much as we do Bosnia, much as we do parts of the other of the Mideast, rest of the Mideast, and Afghanistan and Central Asia. And this is, it's simply written into the job description of any president, Democratic or Republican, that he's going to have to be managing a lot of these situations around the world that are, you know, permanent in the sense we can't see any definite end to them over the horizon, and we simply have to keep an eye on.
Hmm. I can't imagine that term being used in what they refer to as Spin Alley. But where do you think, how do you think the electorate, the American people, feel about this idea that we are in a permanent quagmire?
Well, yeah, you're absolutely right. You're not going to see it in the Spin Alley. You're not going to see it in the political rhetoric of either campaign, nor indeed I would expect of any future presidential candidate. It's, you know, not something that any leader can sort of come out and embrace as a general approach and expect to be elected. I mean, Americans want their leaders to be decisive, to be clear-minded, and they also want to see exit strategies. They want to see a way out of situations. And you know, my only point here is to say, look, we have to have a reckoning with reality. A lot of these situations simply are not going to have pretty endings, and we, the American people, kind of have to accept this reality if we're going to expect our politicians to.
You say it's far more difficult now than it was in the last century to pick our fights and determine our interests. So how then do we go about managing the current foreign policy landscape, the permanent quagmire?
Very, very carefully and with a maximum focus on what help we can get from other countries. And I think, you know, this is really the nub of the criticism of the Bush administration's handling of Iraq, which I think, you know, most people agree, even many Republicans agree, has been quite awkward and ham-handed. You know, people tend to forget in the first Gulf War, run by George W. Bush's father, we practically made a profit. Say what you want about the outcome of that war, the fact that Saddam survived, you know, there's no other conclusion but that it was well managed in terms of mustering an international coalition. Contrast it with the present case, where Americans are dying, sacrificing their limbs, where American taxpayers are spending, you know, up to $200 billion or more on this country, and where despite the rhetoric we hear out of the campaign, there isn't really a great deal of help from the rest of the world. We simply cannot go forward that way, Celeste. It's just not possible. I mean, the facts are that we can't afford it as a country. We can't afford another Iraq. We have no choice but to try to conduct policy with a focus on maximizing international cooperation, and that means achieving consensus and just not being able to go it alone as much as we would like.
Yeah. Not going it alone, you argue that the U.S. and our security needs require respect and cooperation of the international community. And you see the U.S. with a diminished reputation as a result of this war. Let's talk about, you know, something that might be sort of an obvious question, and then I've got another question. Why is it critical to have this respect and support? And if we have been diminished in terms of international respect, how do we go about restoring American credibility?
Well, quite frankly, we can't allow another Iraq to occur. I think people haven't fully gauged how much our credibility has been damaged by this. The next time there is a real threat of weapons of mass destruction and we want to muster a coalition, perhaps to launch a war, just think of how difficult that is going to be. In recent weeks, I've even heard sources on the British side, our most stalwart allies, say never again when it comes to joining an American coalition so badly damaged as Prime Minister Tony Blair been by this effort. So clearly we have to do it a different way. And I think, you know, one of the tragedies, I think, for American foreign policy is that this was not inevitable. People tend to forget now, but by February of 2003, before the invasion of Iraq, George W. Bush had won. He had won a 15-0 Security Council vote in the United Nations. He had the inspectors back in Iraq. He had enormous support. We had support for taking out the Taliban and going after al-Qaeda. Things were going well. I think things really went off the rails when, in spite of European opinion and UN opinion, and the idea that that indeed we had gotten Saddam to cave, we decided to invade anyway. And I think a lot of the ills we're presently dealing with stem from that. So it is possible to do this right. This was not done right in Iraq.
Hmm. How should the U.S. take stock of its interests, of those of the internet and of those of the international community? You know, when is a problem something that demands our attention? And I'll follow up with another question after you answer that one.
Well, you know, it's a very tough test. You know, the 9/11 was a tragedy that had many lessons for us, as we know. We've seen it all fresh out in the newspaper headlines, the 9/11 Commission and all that. One of the lessons, one of the really important and enduring lessons of 9/11, in my view, was the idea that marginal and so-called failed states are no longer something we can ignore. You know, during the 1990s, you may remember, there was something of a national debate going on over Bosnia and Kosovo. Did we need to intervene there? Was it really in our national interest? Was this just humanitarianism run amok? Were we really going to spend money just to save people that we thought were downtrodden and oppressed? That was the nature of the debate. And suddenly, on 9/11, we saw from one of these same states that were once simply the subject of discussions about humanitarian efforts, the worst possible threat ever on our continental soil hit us. And that was, you know, there was a lesson in that. The lesson was we really cannot ignore these places, whether it's nation building, whether it's occupation, whether it's aggressive military efforts to go after terrorists there. Something has to be done. And, you know, it is possible to boil some of these places down. And again, I don't want to harp on the same subject, but I do think one of the tragedies of the diversion of our resources and attention to Iraq is that the real threat did exist and still does in Afghanistan and some of the ungoverned tribal regions of Pakistan, where we really need to be devoting our time, where you really have to be showing up in force to crush al-Qaeda, destroy it, and replace it with something more positive so it can't occur again. And you need to do that in Somalia. You need to do that perhaps in parts of Indonesia, parts of the Philippines, so-called friendly states where you have ungoverned regions. This is the nature of the threat that we face.
So what do you think about the president's doctrine, President George W. Bush's doctrine of preemptive action? Are there circumstances where that's appropriate, or is it never appropriate?
No, I think there's unquestionably circumstances where it's appropriate. It's interesting that you ask that question, because right now we have in the last couple of days some stories that are out about a Pentagon plan to attack Zarqawis. That's Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the chief terrorist, it must be said, in Iraq today, to attack his camp before the Iraq War. And I think that in cases like that, where you have evidence of a terrorist camp in some country that perhaps is not being cooperative or is openly hostile in Iraq, as Iraq was, there's no question that in this era, I think you can declare the right to attack preemptively, or if not declare it, simply exercise it. You know, there's a lot to be said for diplomacy and not sort of getting too overweening in your rhetoric, as I think the Bush administration sometimes has, and you just need to do things, and people will implicitly recognize your right to do that. And I think had we taken out Zarqawi, had we taken out Ansar al-Islam, another terrorist group that was in the northeastern portion of Iraq, I think things would be a lot easier for us right now. So I think it's, what I'm saying is it's important to distinguish between a large-scale preemptive action against a state, which is a very difficult thing to do, which you don't have a lot of support for, as we don't in Iraq, and taking out terrorist groups inside states, where I think we do have the right, given what happened on 9/11, to do so. But it's that kind of precision of analysis that, frankly, has been lacking from the Bush administration's approach to the war on terror, and it's one of the reasons we're in so much trouble.
Hmm. You do say in this book, if I'm remembering correctly, that Bill Clinton's choice to strike at bin Laden may have, in fact, encouraged him. How so?
Well, I do think that there was a lot to the Bush administration's critique coming into office that by simply sort of diddling bin Laden with cruise missile strikes that weren't very effective, we had projected an image of weakness and to some degree invited attack. I think this was really the crux of the critique that Donald Rumsfeld, the defense secretary, made, that President Bush made coming into office. And I think there was something to that. I don't blame Clinton for 9/11, because I don't think anyone predicted that the horrors of 9/11 would be quite as bad as they were. But I think that we were asking for trouble. Bin Laden, after all, had basically taken over Afghanistan to all intents and purposes. He had created enclaves there. He was acting freely. He was planning this enormously complicated operation from there, unmolested by us. And so I think some Clinton people will even tell you in retrospect now they wish they had made better use of special forces or done something more to do what they did. And so, this is Monday morning quarterbacking, but I think in retrospect it would have been better had we taken a much harder line against bin Laden during the Clinton years.
Hmm. The administration, the current administration, the Bush administration, and others say that although no weapons of mass destruction were found in Iraq, the world is better off without Saddam. The region and the world, they say, are safer. What do you think when you hear that argument being made?
I think it misses the point. I have to say, I frankly don't think Kerry and his campaign have been terribly effective in countering that, at least until the last month or so. Of course the world was better off with Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein was a monster. That's not the question. The question is whether or not, at this juncture of history, with this terrible enemy that we had to defeat and really utterly destroy, Al-Qaeda, whether this was the right move to make at that moment. And I say no. I think the evidence is overwhelming that, in fact, this was a disastrous diversion from the real war, that the job against Al-Qaeda was only half done in Afghanistan and Pakistan, to the point where in early 2002, when we had Al-Qaeda and the Taliban on the run, we simply, we basically turned away and decided to devote some of our critical intelligence and special forces resources to gearing up for Iraq. And I think the evidence is in. Even though Afghanistan is looking better and better, the Taliban and Al-Qaeda are still a factor there. We haven't been able to get the chief culprit of 9/11, who was bin Laden. To go back to the question, of course it's better not to have Saddam than to have Saddam. Although right now one must concede that Iraq was more stable and less of a terror threat under Saddam than it is today. There's no question about that. But overall, it's good to be rid of him. It just simply was not the right tactical or strategic move to fight the war on terror.
Mm. What are your thoughts today about Afghanistan and its future? I read recently that NATO had been making some noises that it wanted to scale back its operation in Afghanistan.
Well, they've just had a very, very hopeful election. Hamid Karzai, who is an enormously impressive and gutsy politician, a Pashtun politician who commands the respect of the majority Pashtuns in the country, but also the respect of a lot of the minority groups in Afghanistan, appears to have won an overwhelming victory in the first free election in Afghanistan's long and ancient history. So that's an enormous success. But people who know Afghanistan well, warn that, in the early 90s, there was an election also, it ultimately descended into civil war. It is a country that by its nature is controlled by a lot of warlords. You go to Afghanistan, where I've been, it's enormously mountainous, deep ravines that separate different regions. And so it's a very, very tough challenge to make sure that Afghanistan becomes part of the international community to some degree and does not once again sort of spiral off into failed state status and become a host for groups like Al-Qaeda. So I just think there's a lot of work ahead, but some of the initial steps, despite, I would say, a lot of inattention and not as much funding as could have been done in the early years after the Taliban's fall, despite that, right now, you have to say it's looking more positive.
Journalist Michael Hirsch is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's a senior editor in the Washington Bureau for Newsweek magazine. He's also the author of At War With Ourselves, Why America is Squandering Its Chance to Build a Better World. Let's talk with a listener on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Yeah.
Hi.
You hear me?
Uh-huh.
Good afternoon, Mr. Hirsch. And
good afternoon.
Ms. Quinn?
Mm-hmm.
I've been listening and I haven't read the book, but from what appear to me to be reasonable premises, you've reached logical conclusions and laid it all out just in the past 10 or 15 minutes. But what I don't understand is, with the evidence as clear as that, where do the American people fit in? Because apparently they, for some reason or other, aren't even interested in this. Does anybody read Newsweek? Does anybody read these books? Or does anybody, well, obviously some do, I suppose, but it's as if the truth or logical thinking doesn't seem to matter anymore. Is this a sign of the population that's you know, just interested in the Colosseum and, you know, burning the Christians and watching the Tigers fight the Lions? I mean, so I'm going to hang up and let you dwell on that for a minute.
Well, you know, I do think that, and this goes for the media, my colleagues in the media, as well as the American people and politicians in Washington. After 9/11, I really do think a lot of the country felt itself to be on something of a wartime footing. We didn't fully understand the enemy, but the sentiment was there. The patriotism was there. People wanted to, you know, at a time like that, you naturally band around the president, and you want to, and you're angry. You want vengeance. You want justice. I think most Americans did, and so I think, you know, what has occurred for a good part of the 3 years since 9/11 has been a willingness on the part of the American people to cut the president a lot of slack and to go along because, you know, you want to believe in your government. I think the impulses there are good. I would be less critical in terms of just suggesting that Americans want to tune out. I think that part of the problem is that, in my view, we went in a strategic direction that was not warranted, and we're only really finding out about it and sort of digesting the information about it now. It's only in recent, you know, 6 months, 6 to 8 months, that a lot of the critical reports, the final reports, the definitive reports like the 9/11 Commission reports and others from the Senate Intelligence Committee have come out and basically concluded without any question that there simply was not the case of Belli, that, you know, the reason for war in Iraq that was laid out by the administration. You know, it takes a while to digest all that. It's a complicated issue. So, I mean, if your question is sort of, you know, one that's supposed to go to the idea of, you know, why is it that more people aren't rejecting the policy course taken by the administration, I think it takes a while. And also, I don't want to really accuse the Bush administration of dishonesty, as some do. I think that there was a yes. I think they wanted to go to a war with Iraq because they wanted to teach a lesson to Saddam, and they wanted to turn Saddam into a poster boy for you know, defiant tyrants who might be pursuing WMD. I don't think there's any question about that. But you know, there were a lot of smart people who said, "Look, this was a good idea to do." So, you know, I guess my point is these things take a while to digest. It's enormously complicated, and I would attribute the divisions in the country over the Iraq policy and over these policies in general more to a lot of confusion and trying to catch up with the facts than to anything else.
Let's talk with another listener, a caller in Champaign on line two. Hi.
Oh, is that line two, did you say?
Yes, that's you.
Okay. I can barely hear you over my headset. I have two questions. One is the maybe follow-up on what you were just talking about, the University of Maryland's program on institutional policy attitudes that showed that, you know, people who solidly back Bush fall for all of these misconceptions and don't understand that they're misconceptions. Of no weapons of mass destruction, no link with Al Qaeda, you know, whatever other reasons they said we went to war. And the other thing I wanted to ask you about, I don't know if you've read that or read anything about the University of Maryland's program or study.
I am familiar, I believe, with the study that you're talking about. I cite some University of Maryland statistics in my book, I don't know sort of chapter and verse about.
Well, the conclusion, you know, just latest. The overall thing that I saw from what I've read about it. I haven't read the report itself, but from what I've read about it, is people who were staunchly depending on their faith in Bush and Cheney to tell them the truth, that they just accept everything that Bush and Cheney tell them is the truth.
Yeah, I think that there is something to that. Look, I mean, I have to, you know, I'll lay out fully, you know, where I'm coming from on this. I was I never thought the Iraq War was a good idea, and I was frankly astonished at a lot of my colleagues in the media, particularly the major columnists and major newspapers, who went along with the administration on this. But again, I think a lot of that was this impulse to pull around the president at a time of national crisis. To a large extent, before 9/11, the media had gone overboard in, I think, being too skeptical of government credibility. You know, the sort of post-Vietnam, post-Watergate skepticism of the media had really reached a kind of new height. And we kind of, the pendulum, you know, swung dramatically back in the other direction after 9/11. And I think now it's kind of ending up, you know, where it belongs, which is somewhere in the middle, which is we better closely question what the government tells us. And I think that, again, as I said earlier, this is going to take a long time to digest exactly what went wrong here. I think there's going to be a whole generation of historians who are going to, you know, be selling their Ph.D. Treatises to their advisors on the basis of what happened in the last 2 years.
If we could still speak out freely. The other thing I had a question about, and I don't know if you've thought about this, but I just read something recently where there's only going to be one source for the raw vote totals for the election coming up, and that's through the AP. And I was wondering if the raw vote totals were only ever in our past given to one news organization or one, whether, you know, like all of the major channels, all the major, like ABC, NBC.
You know, I don't know about that specifically, but, you know, I can assure you, given the way we're going to be covering this election, there's going to be reporters at all the major in all the major states, electoral districts, and I don't think that, you know, there's any danger that, I'm not saying that there won't be any fraud, but I don't think there's any danger that there's just going to be one pipeline for all the election data. I'm not sure what...
Well, it seems to me that, from what I have read, is that the AP will be the only source for getting all the raw vote totals from all of the states.
Yeah, well, the AP, I mean, I worked for the AP for 7 years, and I know the way it works quite well. It's a wonderful organization. It also is the only organization, the only news organization that is so widespread and has reporters in so many cities and towns across the country that would probably be suited to do something like that. There isn't any other news organization that could do that. And typically, if you know anything about the AP, newspapers and magazines, particularly especially newspapers and television stations, for that matter, all depend on the AP wire for you know, as their main source of news, particularly from localities. So there's no great surprise in that, and I don't think there's any great danger in it either.
Let's talk with another listener, a caller in Champaign on line 3. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, I would like to hear the guest speak about the American-Israeli relationship. People do not discuss it very much in America because fear of anti-Semitism, but I think it's something there needs to be a dialogue about, and I would be interested in his outlook on that.
Yeah. Well, it's enormously complicated. I think that it is one of the reasons we have this administration has engendered so much enmity in the Arab world, is that it's been seen as really tilting too much to Israel's side. And so you have this really terrible situation where essentially a lot of the Arab world and indeed other countries to some degree see the United States and Israel basically as in bed together. And of course, in some of the sort of more savage criticisms you hear the whole, you know, this whole idea that largely Jewish neoconservatives in Washington are essentially running American foreign policy in Israel's interest, which I think is terribly exaggerated, does not reflect the reality at all. But it just shows you how the current policy has really spiraled off into this this very, very dark vision that the rest of the world has of the United States. My own view is that there were opportunities for doing something, but at the same time, after the failed Camp David talks of 2000 under Bill Clinton and the beginning of the Intifada in September of 2000, there were not a lot of great opportunities for coming to some kind of a conclusion. You know, you now have this bizarre situation where Ariel Sharon, the Israeli prime minister, who was demonized by much of the world for being a right-wing, essentially an Arab hater, is now trying to, you know, desperately trying to move his country to the center and leave Gaza to the point where right-wing Israelis are now threatening his life. So it's a very, very dangerous situation. It certainly could do with a lot more American diplomacy, but I think that you're probably going to need a new administration to do that.
Let's talk with another caller on line one, a listener in Urbana. Hi.
Hello. I had a question about similar to this last caller, but a little different. It seems to me that President Bush has kind of wrapped the flag around the crucifix and gotten a lot of support from the Christian right for the war. And as I talk to people, they identify that the war probably wasn't the right thing to do, but that we absolutely have to do it.
Yeah.
And again, the idea of that inflaming the Islamic world.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure what your question is. Has he wrapped the flag around the crucifix?
Well, he's talked about a holy war. He's actually called it a crusade.
Yeah, I mean, Bush himself, I think, has been very careful not to do that. I do think that some of the people who work for him, like Lieutenant General Boykin, was the Deputy Chief of Intelligence of the Pentagon, who did portray the war in those terms, basically Christian versus Muslims, and was not really slapped down or fired, I think he should have been. Have caused problems for Bush. I mean, he hasn't distanced himself enough from people who do talk in those terms, because it is very dangerous. I don't buy the idea that there's a clash of civilizations, and that all Arabs see this fight with bin Laden as only the latest installment in a millennium-long battle between Islam and Christianity. I think that's a lot of nonsense, and unfortunately, some people like Bernard Lewis have been inordinately influential on that score when many experts in their field say that they simply have gotten it wrong. But that's what we're dealing with now, especially since having invaded Iraq, many Arabs have now sort of said, well, maybe bin Laden was right, maybe we are latter-day crusaders and Mongols and so forth. So we have a lot of work to do to get ourselves out of the hole that we've dug ourselves into, and to get back to the point where we were around 9/11, which is when al-Qaeda and bin Laden were really seen as marginal, on the sick margins of the Arab world, and were not seen as mainstream expressions. And we have to remind ourselves that even though a lot of the Arab world remains silent on bin Laden or even cheers him on quietly, they're not becoming terrorists. And we simply cannot afford a situation where we turn, you know, the world's 1-point-something billion Muslims into an enemy. That is a disaster for generations to come, and it simply doesn't reflect reality.
Okay, thank you very much.
And next we talk with a listener in Urbana on line two. Hi.
Hello, thanks for taking my call. I was wondering if you could comment on what I inferred from Michael Moore's film, Fahrenheit 9/11, on the connection between the Bush family, Saudi Arabia, the oil industry, and if there's a benefit to Saudi Arabia to have Saddam Hussein removed from power.
I thought that was the part of the Michael Moore film that really was way over the top, and I can tell you with some authority, because as a reporter I've looked into this along with my colleagues at Newsweek, you know, in other words, the connections between Bush and Saudi Arabia, the issue of whether bin Laden family members were allowed to leave because of some sort of nefarious connection. It simply is not really, it's just not the case. To the extent that that Bush was kind of pulling for the Saudis, it's something that other presidents have done. We have had this relationship with Saudi Arabia going back to FDR. It has far more to do with our dependence on foreign oil, which we've done almost nothing about since 9/11. But since the Saudis are the number one supplier of oil, we have this relationship with them. Yes, the Saudis have fomented this Wahhabist extreme version of Islam in which bin Laden himself was raised. They've tried to sit on the fence, sort of, you know, as a tacit bargain with the terrorists, saying, don't attack us here. And we will look the other way and maybe even send you some charity money. That was the bargain of the past. That's kind of gone now. I think that they're still sort of on the fence, but at the same time, Al-Qaeda has been attacking them in their home territory. And some of the allegations made in Fahrenheit 9/11, you know, the idea that that somehow the Saudis were complicit and Bush was complicit with the Saudis in 9/11, there's absolutely no evidence to back that up at all. This is a different problem from that, and I have to say that that part of the movie simply did not square with the facts as I know them.
Thanks. My other question was about Bush's statement that he wasn't concerned where Osama bin Laden was, and at one point he said, I don't give him much thought, I don't really think about him. And
yeah.
What do you make of that?
Well, I think that that is, you know, an unfortunate result of the fact that we haven't been able to get him. I mean, think about this. The chief culprit of 9/11, the guy who planned and oversaw and financed this terrible attack on our country, goes free today, and we haven't devoted all of our resources to getting him. Of course the president is going to say, I don't think about him that much, because otherwise, you know, the inevitable questions would continue to arise. Why haven't we gotten him yet? But the fact of the matter is that if you look at Bush's speeches right after 9/11, Al-Qaeda was the enemy. You remember, dead or alive, that's what he said about bin Laden. He carries pictures of bin Laden and other Al-Qaeda leaders, and he holds them in his desk. There's no question that they still want to get him. I do think that given the diversion into Iraq and the fact that we've engendered so much anger and enmity in the Arab world, that bin Laden is less important than he used to be. I do think had we gotten him in the months after 9/11 and just destroyed Al-Qaeda, which we needed to do, it would have been easier to simply get rid of the threat. Now we're in a situation where the bin Laden legend has lived on for 3 years and, you know, engendered other groups that are trying to follow in his footsteps. And so the actual fact of getting him, capturing or killing him, would not be as important strategically as it was, but I still think it's important. And I think it's extremely disingenuous of the Bush administration to say that we just don't think about him that much. This is the guy who, you know, who is responsible for 9/11. Let's not take our eyes off the ball here.
Thanks. And my last thing, the war on terror, I mean, I've heard people talk about terror being more of a tactic, and what are we having a war against? How can we have a war against a tactic? I mean, we have a war against terrorism that we're trying to eliminate it, but...
Yeah. Well, I think it's a very fair point, I think it is a misnomer. The British, for example, our best allies don't even use that phrase. They use the campaign against terror. And indeed, you know, the war is against a brand of Islamist extremism fomented by Wahhabism, by bin Laden, and by Ayman Zawahiri, who brings with him the sort of extremist Egyptian tradition going back to a fellow named Sayyid Qutb, who is sort of the founding philosopher of all this. This is what the war is against. The war is against this brand of extremist Islam that seeks to paint the entire world Islamic green, or at least the Middle East, and gives no quarter. That's the war, and we should be saying so. For the administration, it was convenient to use such a loose term as the war on terror because they directed their attention against Iraq, which had little or nothing to do with the war against Islamic extremism.
So are they driving us by making us afraid?
I think there is something to that, yes. I know that was in Fahrenheit 9/11 as well, and I think there is a lot to that. If you look at the campaign rhetoric right now, it's all about who is going to make us less afraid, and you find Kerry on the defensive here needing to respond to Bush and Cheney, and their charges that he simply, you know, would not be an effective commander-in-chief.
I want to thank the listener for the call, and we're going to squeeze in one more call this afternoon, but we'll have to kind of keep an eye on the time because we're drawing down here. Line one, Champaign County, go ahead.
Thank you. Since there's only a moment, I wanted to ask you something specifically about what Newsweek did in the coverage of this Naeem Khan fellow. Later on, this happened just before the Democratic Convention, and the terror alert was raised, and there was a big to-do made of it. And in British press and other places, you could read about the fact that the guy was actually a mole. he was actually being used by the British and the Pakistani intelligence to try to bring in some. And Ridge actually apologized during Blair's party conference. I think they exacted that out of them because the British intelligence was very furious about this. Did Newsweek cover this? I don't understand why it's not an issue, because it just seemed like a blatant manipulation of the terror color scheme with a political aim. I don't know. You don't have to.
I know exactly what you're talking about. We did cover it. I know. You know. We have a very active website, and we do a lot of our original stories on the website. I can't tell you exactly where the story appeared on the website or in the magazine itself, but there's no question that we covered it. You know, these are very tough things for journalists to cover. I'm constantly getting people like you asking, well, why don't you guys just come out and say, this was an obvious political manipulation by the Bush administration to divert attention, you know, from the Democratic Convention, which is what the allegation is, and to discuss terror and to say, well, you stand behind our president and don't pay attention to what's happening in Boston at the Democratic Convention. That's the essential allegation. And, look, perhaps that's true, but, you know, we're reporters. We print what we know to be true. And sometimes the facts don't always lead to some inevitable conclusion like that. I mean, it's very possible that that was part of the motivation behind what Tom Ridge said. But we simply, you know, we simply don't know for sure. And all we can do is print the facts. And that's what we did.
Okay, that's where we'll have to leave it. We've gone past our time, actually, a little bit here this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, journalist Michael Hirsch, a senior editor in the Washington Bureau for Newsweek magazine, the author of At War With Ourselves, Why America is Squandering Its Chance to Build a Better World. The book is now available in paperback from Oxford University Press. Michael Hirsch, thank you very much for joining us today.
I'm very happy to have done it.
And that was an interview from October of last year. You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. I'm Celeste Quinn. Settlement prices are in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks very much, Celeste. On this beautiful February afternoon, futures finished the day like this in the wheat pit at the Board of Trade. Soft red winter wheat March contract today had a high of $2.91. The low there at $2.88. Settled at $2.89 3/4, up a penny and a half for the day. The May futures were up 1 3/4 with the high at $2.99. Low at $2.96 and a settlement price at $2.98 1/2. July futures at the Board of Trade in the wheat pit, $3.05 1/2 the high, the low at $3.03. The harvest month for the soft red winter wheat settled at $3.05. They were up a penny and 3/4 for the day in the September contract, $3.11 the high, the low at $3.09. Settlement price at $3.11, up 2 1/4 for the day. December futures, $3.20 the high, the low at $3.18. Settled at $3.19 1/4 a bushel, up 2 1/4. From the corn pit now, the March contract, a $1.95 1/4 high. That used to be the old contract low. The new contract low made today, $1.94 1/4. That's a new low. And a settlement price at $1.95. That's a new low settlement price as well. Finished down 0.25 cent. May futures, $2.03 1/4 the high, the low at $2.02 1/4. Settled $2.03. They were off 0.25 cent. And July, $2.10 3/4 the high, the low at $2.09 3/4. July corn settled $2.10 1/2, unchanged for the day. September futures, $2.18 1/4 in the corn pit for the high, the low at $2.17 1/4, settled at $2.18 unchanged. And your new crop December for the harvest month, $2.28 1/4 the high, the low at $2.27, settled at $2.28 a bushel even, up 0.25 cent. March futures for next year, 2006 March corn, $2.35 3/4 the high, the low at $2.34 1/2, a settlement price there at $2.35 1/2, and they were up 0.5. May oats for the day, a $1.66 1/2 high, low at $1.63. Settlement price at $1.63 1/4, down 2 1/2 cents a bushel. And the May contract, a $1.58 1/2 high, the low at $1.55 3/4. Settlement price at $1.56, and they finished down 2 1/4. The first oat contract, by the way, was March, not May. March beans now, $5.08 the high, the low at $5.01 1/2. A settlement price at $5.02. They were down 3 1/4, and the May, $5.08 1/2 high, low at $5.03, settled at $5.04 1/4. They were off 2 cents for the May soybeans. July futures, a $5.09 3/4 settlement price, off 2 1/2 the high, and the July $5.14 3/4 the low at $5.09 1/4. August soybean futures, $5.18 the high, the low at $5.12 1/2. Settled $5.13 a bushel, down 2, and the September futures, a $5.18 high there as well. The low at $5.15 1/4, settled on that low at $5.15 1/4 cents a bushel for the Septembers. They were off 3. New crop November beans, $5.29 the high, the low at 5.23, settled at $5.23¾, down 2½. And the January 2006 bean contract at 5.34 for the high, the low at 5.29, settled down on that low at $5.29 a bushel for the January soybeans, down 3 cents. March bean meal now, 152.70 the high, the low at 150.60, settled 150.70, they were off $1.50, and the May bean meal, 153 the high, low at 151.40, and a settlement price at 151.50. They were down $1.10 for the day. March bean oil, 19.03 the high, the low at $18.82, settled 18.86. They were off 8 cents. And the May bean oil, 19.18 the high, the low at 19.01. Settlement price there at 19.08, finished a nickel lower. Now, with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange, here's Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, Todd. March feeder cattle, today's high $100.15, the low $99.27.5, the settlement $99.80, that down 15. April $99.70, the high $98.80, the low $99.55, the settlement, that down 22.5. May $99.05, the high $98.30, the low $98.97.5, the settlement, that down 20. February live cattle $91.05, the high $90.05, the low, the settlement $91.00, that up 30. April live cattle $88.47.5, the high $87.55, the low $88.25, the settlement, that unchanged. Lean hogs finished higher today. February lean hog, 71.80 the high, 70.80 the low, 71.75 the settlement, that up 12.5. April, 73.45 the high, 72.50 the low, 73.20 the settlement, that up 7.5. May, 74.50 the high, 73.55 the low, the settlement, 74.35, that up 25. June lean hog, 76.90 the high, 75.50 the low, 76.75 the settlement, that up 67.5. And February bellies down the limit today, 90.90 the high, 87.92.5 the low, 87.92.5 the settlement, that down $3. The Dow is off 20 points, the NASDAQ off 20 points, and the S&P 500 down 5.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Pebble Gifford from Moynihan's Bluff, California writes, Dear Dr. Science, what happens to used gravity?
You leave behind residual gravity with every step you take, but since gravity itself is so plentiful, this second-hand gravity is of little use to the layperson. It is used mainly by the unscrupulous gravity mongers, who mix it with helium and sell it to basketball teams. Then, through a complicated and illegal remote control system, they control the passage of the ball and the outcome of the game, raking in millions with side bets. So used gravity is mainly used for point shaving. Until now, gravity has been provided free, but if the illegal use of gravity does not cease, the makers of gravity will soon be forced to charge a gravity toll.